So, well, I would say that I'm very moved to be here, honestly, because I met Christine in 2012 in Beirut, and just by accident, and she came to a talk I was giving on Fromanger with one of the artists involved. And after that, she told me about their project, and it's fantastic. And over the year, I follow all that they have been doing, and they are thanking everybody and saying we are all amazing. But honestly, they are much more amazing because their project is like one of the best examples for research, I would say. I mean, it's detective, it's fantastic. So I'm very moved, and I hope I don't bore you too much after all this excitement. So, as Paz, Rasha, and Christine have just reminded us, writing a global history of art, welcoming to artists and practices outside the main stories, is one of the great challenges faced by the discipline today. And supplementing the main story by adding chapters on non-Western region may seem the easiest and most obvious solution, but it is a problematic one. And as Beatrice Royer-Prunel and I have argued with Thomas da Costa Kaufmann in Circulation in the Global History of Art, this approach is problematic because those added chapters do not fundamentally change the main narrative. The new stories include peripheral regions and groups, but only to prove that they follow the same avant-garde logics as the center, be it Paris or New York, and to establish who, from the periphery, can enter the modernist canon, thereby preserving the symbolic hierarchy and process of exclusion that are at the center of Western modernism. So far from resulting in a global, all-encompassing history of art, we end up westernizing world history. To demonstrate that global art history is not the reverse side of Western art history, but of national and cultural separations, we gather essays that illustrate how following the transnational circulation of artists, artworks, and style provide a way to escape national narratives and to write the transnational story of a connected art world. This was also the ambition of the Artlas Bulletin, which Beatrice Royer-Prunel and I have been editing since 2012, that published essays with strong transnational focus. And questioning the national narrative was also at the core of a book I published in 2015 on the rise and fall of American art. So to give you a little idea, as we all know, after World War II, New York replaced Paris as the international center of the art world, before being challenged in the 80s by Cologne and Turin. To explain such movement, art historians have usually relied on aesthetic or social argument, presenting one group's triumph as almost the inevitable result of its artistic greatness, superiority, or cultural relevance. And the shift of focus as the inevitable recognition of its superiority. My ambition for that book was to tackle the question a little bit differently and to replace the aesthetic or a national approach with a geopolitical analysis of the art world. So geopolitics, as Yves Lacoste redefined it, starting in 1976 with La géographie, ça sert d'abord à faire la guerre, provides a model for studying power relations from a broad historical and geographical perspective. And although art history as a discipline, as a story of struggle, triumphs, hero, would naturally lend itself to a geopolitical analysis, geopolitics has not really penetrated our field so much, at a few exceptions, from of which Beatrice Royer-Prunel's work on the internationalization of the historical avant-garde is a very good example. So with the rise and fall of American art, I was proposing geopolitics as a model to better understand the power structure and conflict in the art world, and trying to show what a geopolitical approach could bring to our understanding of the history of art. So the goal of geopolitics analysis has less to do with explaining the event, but rather to understand the origin of the crisis that led to the event, and to really understand the motivation of the protagonists who participated in them. Geopolitics has thus replaced even in the long durée of history and in the broad expanse of geography. So likewise, I attempted not merely to analyze the shift of power, the art world like New York, Paris, the fall of Paris, or the invasion of New York, but to trace out in detail the long succession of alliances and rivalries that led to those relocations. For the same reason, I adopted a broad multicultural approach, because the shifts are never between Paris and New York, or New York and Berlin, or Cologne. It is much more complicated. Far from being passive onlookers, surrounding countries such as the Netherlands or Belgium are very active participants, even more because of the attention they themselves brought to the center. So a full appreciation, I think, of the global situation of the art world requires detailed assessment of the position, situation, and motivation of each of the protagonists involved in the different moment. For this reason, the analysis always needs to shift between the local and the global, the national and the transnational. So, as I said, the event is not the primary object of the analysis, but rather what Lacoste called the geopolitical representation of the event. This is the way each protagonist perceive, discuss, and remember what happened. So, the fall of Paris, if we take an example, can refer to many things. It can be, at first, event like ranging from the invasion of Paris by the German in 1940 to Robert Rauschenberg winning the Grand Prize from painting in the Venice Biennale of 1964. Depending on the perspective adopted, the phrase will take very different meaning and refer to different dates. So, while in 1961, the Dutch curator Eddy de Ville asserted, "It is in Paris more than anywhere else, reception center for artists of all nationalities, that the entire range of painting become visible," almost the same time, Thomas Hesse, an American art critic, wrote, "We all know what happened to International School of Paris painting at some time in between 1939 and 1945. It ceased to exist. Yet in 1946, when Paris was no longer the center of the art world in his mind, Greenberg was still claiming the dominance of Paris. Paris remained the fountainhead of modern art, and every move made there is decisive for advanced art elsewhere, which is advanced precisely because it can respond to an extent to the vibration of the nerve center and nerve end of modernity, which is Paris." Those three statements display contradictory vision of Paris' position, yet it doesn't mean that one is correct and the other are wrong. They are contradictory, but not exclusive. They represent possible representation people could have of the power structure of the art world at that time. So, following Michel Foucault, the geopolitical approach aims at understanding why certain views are possible at certain moment in certain place. And so to provide a genealogy of the multiple perspectives that made the history of art in that period. So the geopolitical analysis allows us to better understand the shift in the power structure of the art world by analyzing the way in which the various protagonists, be they country, institution, or individual, constructed their own representation of the events and how their own view, ambition, strategy wound up creating and shaping those events. So to continue with still this example of the decline of French art, because it's an easy one, in the post-war period, let's look at another statement made much later by the American philosopher Arthur Danto in a book on 20th century American art. French painting between the wars and after the Second World War exemplifies so protracted a decline that the final three quarters of 20th century could be written with scarcely a mention of France. Such a comment is interesting, not so much for what it says, the irrelevance of French art in the second part of the 20th century is really a very predictable cliché in post-war Western art, especially coming from the US, but rather for the time frame it provides. While usually we place the decline of Paris during the war or after the war, in Danto's view, it's already over at the beginning of the century. Unless it's actually over much before. And indeed, if you do a quick review of the American literature on France, that revealed that the end had been announced long before the 20th century. In fact, the French decadence is a recurring motif of American thinking of French of France since the beginning of the American Franco-American relations, since the 18th century, even 17th century. From that review, one is drawn to conclude that the so-called post-war decadence of French art is part of a rich and long tradition that defined the United States as strong, moral, thriving, in comparison to a perceived decadent France. The motivation on stake varied, but the cliché remained the same. Comments on France's creative exhaustion uttered from the US, such as Danto, thus need to be historicized and considered first and foremost as discursive argument. In 1964, the Parisian art critic Michel Ragon interviewed the American painter Robert Motherwell and asked his opinion about on contemporary French art. So Motherwell responded, "It is my opinion that French art is completely crushed." Under what? Crushed from the inside. It is a moral issue. After read the transcript of his interview, Motherwell sent a letter to Ragon trying to rectify his comments. "The true response is that I'm not very well informed about the current situation of the School of Paris. I have not spent more than a couple of days in Paris over the past 25 years. I do not know if the French artists that are exhibited in New York are representative of what is happening in Paris, where there might be excellent artists that we do not see here." Demonstrating rare lucidity, Motherwell realized that the moral argument, so commonplace in New York, was begging the question, and that he and his fellow American could only have incomplete knowledge of contemporary French art. If they did not go to New York, to Paris, they could only know what was coming to their doorstep, which could only offer a very partial view of French production. Art magazine would have been the only way to learn about new art made in France. But by then, French magazines had lost their significance, and many, like the Cahiers des Arts, had disappeared altogether. The production of knowledge about contemporary art was in the end of the US-based art magazine, which at best were uninterested in French art and at worst hostile to it. They failed to feature French artists so that reading them, you have the impression that indeed nothing was happening in Paris anymore. In 1966, when Donald Judd famously discussed European art, his exact word were, "I'm not interested in European art. I think it's over." It was indeed a matter of interest, first and foremost. Nothing interesting was happening in France, not because artists were suddenly lost their creative power, but because the international art world was no longer interested in what they were doing. Their attention had shifted to New York. throwing Parisian artists from the spotlight into media invisibility. As such, the low profile of Parisian artists is not a problem. I mean, many artists had been overlooked in the first part of the 20th century because of the prevalence of Paris. Perhaps this deserved their subsequent invisibility. They were now sharing the fate of artists not based in New York, be they in Brussels, Berlin, Chicago. So, but from a historiographic point of view, the French situation is particularly interesting because Paris was on the center of attention. But most importantly for me, because the decline of French art was the key narrative of the American century plot on which our understanding of post-war Western art rests. Indeed, the decline of French artists is a necessary flip side of the triumph of American art on which the understanding of post-war art is constructed. Without the inferiority of French art, the American artist cannot be great. It is telling that Danton's comment about the decadence of French art is written in a book on American art, not on French art. Because the decline of French art has little to do with what was actually going on in France at the time. It is nothing, to my mind, but a literary device in the triumphant narrative of American art, because as Danton said, it's all about writing the history of art. And since it is about writing the history of art, I decided to edit a book on a collection of essays on France on the visual art since 1945, when nothing was happening. And to be sure, the collection of essays is not about French art, French artists. I don't know, none of the authors know what exactly that adjective means. It is more about post-war and contemporary art with sometimes a strong, sometimes a weak connection to France. This connection never being central to the argument of the author. In fact, the essays were really selected for their transnational implication. And as a whole, we hope, me and the author, that they contribute to write a story of post-war and contemporary art that move beyond nationalist narratives and rather highlight transnational connection. My personal ambition for the book was to further deconstruct the myth of triumph and exhaustion that are at the core of the American narrative. So in the introduction, I thus try to understand how that old cliché of French decadence became regarded as a fact everywhere, even in France, and how this affected and continued to affect the historiography of post-war Western art. But I also raised the question of what it would take to rewrite France in the official story of the period. Take, for instance, the case of the Jeune Peinture, whose activity, including its participation to the international exhibition for Palestine, bring us here today. Their activity really exemplified rather perfectly what was going on in Paris in the 1960s and 1970s, that is, at a time when, according to the American narrative, there was nothing worth mentioning happening in Paris. So while I can easily explain why they are not part of the canon on geopolitical ground, I mean, that, yes, I can, it's easy, I stumbled trying to write them in the main narrative of art history. I mean, if I try to squeeze them between pop art and minimalism, it does not really work. Trying to insert the salle verte, so the green room for which a group of jeunes peintres agreed to each make a 2-meter-square painting using only the color green, between Roy Lichtenstein and Donald Judd is problematic, to say the least. And it is problematic because by doing this, I'm using pop art and minimalism as a reference point against which I have to assess and justify the Jeune Peinture activity instead of considering them in their own context and logics. And needless to say, the comparison does not play in their favor. So rather than trying to squeeze their poster, banderole, and action in that story, what we could do, and what I tried to do in the introduction of France of the Visual Art, is to expose how the master narrative is rooted in a US experience and come up with a different analytical grid, or I would say a grille de lecture in French, something that would help me to do justice to the jeune peinture. For instance, it will be very reductive to read the events in of the Parisian art world through a Cold War lens, because it's not the most important geopolitical event in that country. Decolonization, and in particular the Indochina War and the Algerian War, were. As Anna Feldman shows so well in her book From a Nation Torn, Decolonizing Art and Representation in France, 1945-1962, the artistic production of post-war France need to be considered in the specific context of decolonization. More than the Cold War, it is the disturbing and pervasive background in which art was created. And the political radicalization of the jeune peinture in the 1960s was a direct result of the Algerian War, the terrorist action launched by the Organisation Armée Secrète after February 1961, and the attempted military coup in April 1961, creating an urge among artists to act against fascism and militarism at home and abroad, an urge that Eduardo Arroyo described as a need to participate totally to the real, that is to say, to accuse, to denounce, to cry out, and not to fear taboo subjects such as politics and sexuality, an urge to which the jeune peinture offered a stage. The Cold War lens is also reductive because it suggests an ideological divide between two models. Yet in France, the landscape was much more complicated, not only because the Parti communiste was a major political actor, but because the political spectrum expanded far to the left. The PCF was criticized because it was the establishment from the left. So the leftist critic of communism was particularly strong among intellectuals and artists who rejected the PCF because of its link to Moscow, and instead adopted a palette of Marxist position from Trotskyism, Maoism, and socialism to different types of anarchism. And I think that unless you understand the complex, to say the least, political landscape of post-war France and grasping the subtle difference between the Marxist, Maoist, anarchist groupuscule, as well as their transformation before and after 68, you don't understand art produced in France at the time, and especially when it comes to the history of the jeune peinture, it makes no sense. Even though seen from afar, especially from New York, they are all communist, from Paris, they are very different. And I think you know what I'm talking about. Not only does the jeune peinture require to be seen through a different geopolitical and ideological lens than American art, it also needs a different aesthetic reading grid. While in the United States, Clement Greenberg's idea and past talk about the importance of formalism Greenberg is so important in the US. His idea dominates aesthetic debate for most of the second part of the 20th century, either as a model or as a foil. But you have to talk, yes, we have to talk about it. In France, Greenberg's texts were not translated until 1988, and until the 1960s, his name is not very well known. So you cannot apply any of those to their work. In the French context, where most intellectuals and artists adhere to one form of Marxist thinking or another, and from Jean-Paul Sartre to Michel Foucault regarded political engagement as their duty, aesthetic questions were posed in very different terms. In the page of the Bulletin de la Jeune Peinture, Gilles Ayot, who had studied philosophy and whose idea followed the thinking of Louis Althusser, Maurice Merleau-Ponty, and other French thinkers, repeatedly presented modern art as a myth created by the bourgeois capitalist society to serve its own interest. Part of the myth involved the concept of creative freedom, according to which the artists are totally free to create whatever they want. Yet, artists had to express themselves within the limit of a physical medium and a formal language that restrict their freedom of expression. Moreover, artists are always the product of a general and artistic education that shape their creativity such that they are never absolutely free. Artistic freedom was nothing but an illusion, a perverse illusion which made artists believe that they are free so that they do not see the need to fight for their freedom. Another aspect of the bourgeois myth of modern art was the autonomy of art, which postulated that art exists outside the world and can remain unaffected by the logic of society. Ayo thus regarded art for the sake of art as a trick. By making art autonomous, it became disconnected from the real world and its problem, and reduced to the world of form and color. Ayo thus invited artists to reject the illusionary autonomy of art and instead, quote, to manifest themselves as true individuals in time and space, because only then can we show that as painter, we intend to get involved in what they want us to believe does not concern us, that is the affair of the world and not forms and color. The third aspect of the myth Ayo attacked was the quest of originality, which leads artists to always try to be more autonomous from the world. Quote, while the bourgeoisie systematically encouraging cultural novelty? The answer may be found in the assertion, because it does not call anything into question, end of quote. Besides carrying artists deeper into formal investigation and farther away from the world, the cult of originality also isolate artists from one another, trapping them in their individual styles and personality. As solitary individual, artists have no power. The quest for originality and individuality culminate in the myth of the avant-garde, in which formal revolution is mistaken for real revolution. For their 18th Salon, which was scheduled for June 1968, the jeune peintre acted on this idea by planning a collective project, the so-called Salle Rouge pour le Vietnam, so Red Room for the Vietnam, in which individual creativity was to be subsumed under a common political goal. The painting had to have the same size, 2 by 2 meters, a clear ideological content, and had to be vetted beforehand by all the participants. In those discussions, form was considered only in the extent in which it influenced the message, and the success of a painting was not measured on its formal quality, but ideological legibility. Due to the event of May 68, the Salon was postponed, but the Salle Rouge was presented in Paris in January 1969. But that was not enough for them. To really engage with the world and get a larger audience, they took the Salle Rouge on a tour of France. They presented at the Alstom factory in Belfort, on the street in front of the factory Berlier in Bourg-en-Bresse, in the street of Besançon, and in several Maisons des Jeunes throughout the country. And I think you may not recognize any of those cities. They were small cities, but they wanted to bring art. However, the Salle Rouge was not presented in any communist city, apart from Bagnolet, because 3 participants lived there, because, as I explained, the jeune peinture was as antagonist to communist establishment as they were to the bourgeois system. So it goes without saying that all that I have just said is not intended to provide a complete analytical grid for reading the activity of the jeune peinture. I mean, we have limited time. But I still hope that this quick overview of instance when a local story is at odds with the overarching US narrative help us see how much this story is restrictive. It looks at post-war art through a New York lens that we cannot use to interpret the situation in other regions without running the risk of distortion and misunderstanding. As we try to be more inclusive in our account of 20th century art, this reminds us that we cannot simply add chapter on previously overlooked region. It is hardly an improvement to move from excluding peripheral region and group to distorting their specific experience and misunderstanding their unique practice so that we can squeeze them into an established narrative. Be it the Parisian one before the first part of the 20th century, or the New York one in the posterior years. Focusing on international circulation and network, as Rasha and Christine did with Past Disquiet, seem a much more promising solution. And the book, Past Disquiet, to which I had the privilege to participate, is to my mind a very, very, very good example of this kind of approach that allows us to understand really the motivation, perspective of each of the individual participants of the international exhibition for Palestine, really without focusing also on the local content and always moving between the local and the global. And I think a lot of the paper that are coming after me are going to give us example. And I would just ask you to pay attention, because you would see maybe here or there some people from the Jeune Peinture, and then we can start to thread where they fit in the story. Thank you.